The 33 men pulled up from the depths of Chile's San Jose mine this week looked strong and proud. Victors, not victims. Their survival was a marvel that enlisted drillers, engineers, doctors, geologists, scientists, psychiatrists, bureaucrats, clergy, and volunteers from around the world. But the men saved themselves, too. They had the hard, hidden part, living with isolation, hunger, and despair for 69 days, trapped in a small, dark space 2,000 feet below the ground that tried to crush them. They told reporters yesterday the first 17 days were hardest. They had no word from the surface or proof they were being searched for. Some of the men squabbled, which they've made a pact never to speak about. They made jokes about cannibalism as they watched themselves starve. After 17 days, the refuge chamber into which they'd scrambled to escape began to feel as close as a tomb. Now the men, who may always be known as Los Treinta y Tres, can look ahead to sunnier days. Chile's president, Sebastián Piñera, embraced each miner as he emerged and said, "You're not the same after this, and neither are we. We will never forget this." I think that "we" embraces the world. Millions of families, including ours, got our children out of bed to watch the men rise from the earth, wave, sing, and blow kisses. We told our children, "Remember this night, whenever you think something is impossible." President Piñera says he also knows this magnificent achievement stemmed from what may be reckless disregard of mine safety. Never again, he says, will we permit people to work in conditions so unsafe and inhuman as they worked in the San Jose mine. It's tempting to say the rescue of the miners, like the landing on the moon or the return of Apollo 13, shows that humans can do anything if we just work together. Landing on the moon or rescuing 33 miners are daunting but direct enterprises. They have start points and finish lines. The trials of war, famine, terrorism, poverty, global warming, joblessness, and loneliness twist and turn. But this week it was good to be reminded that skill, courage, and dedication can also move the earth. When 33 men were buried, people uncovered strength they never knew was inside. Failure was not an option. This week we were all Chilean. Viva! The San Jose Miners. You're listening to NPR News. Now, from the open road to the open sky, you might have a fish for dinner tonight that was flown in fresh from the Mediterranean. Get roses that were picked yesterday in Chile. For all the ways in which the World Wide Web, texting, Twitter, YouTube are celebrated for interconnecting our world, somehow Verhovic tells a story in his new book about how the invention of jet travel just over 50 years ago is the force that first superseded borders, bringing Dutch backpackers to Disneyland and making it as easy for families in New Jersey to see the Eiffel Tower this summer as the Grand Canyon. Mr. Verhovic's new book is Jet Age, The Comet, the 707, and the Race to Shrink the World. He joins us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott.
The period you write about from the post-war era to the early 60s was the Cold War.
Yes.
But the adversaries in this struggle were old allies.
Absolutely. It came down to a great Anglo-American competition for supremacy in building a jet airliner. And I really try to give credit to the Brits. They were the first to build a jet airliner. They were willing to go years before anybody else did. They kind of pushed the envelope, and tragically they paid the price for it. The Comet, the de Havilland Comet, the first jet airliner, took the world by storm when it started flying passengers in 1952. But after a year, they started having these just horrible accidents where the plane essentially blew apart in the sky and killed everybody aboard.
To see pictures of the de Havilland Comet today, it's an utterly beautiful airplane with the engines kind of concealed in the wing.
Yes.
Was that part of its fatal flaw?
The engines in the wing were not really the cause ultimately of these three incidents where the plane just blew apart in the air. They were a factor in two other incidents on takeoff, one fatal, one not.
We should explain there was some theory that they created more vibrations that led to earlier fatigue of the metal.
Right. It took three of these accidents. After the first two, the British authorities concluded that the airplane itself was still structurally sound, and it was only after the third one that they really conceded that this plane, you know, had a flaw, that all had to be taken out of service, and they really worked very hard to figure out what the mysterious flaw was and to be able to fix it and redesign the plane so that they could still somehow beat the upstart Americans that were coming ahead with their version of a jetliner.
What did Boeing get right that de Havilland didn't?
You know, I think more than anything, what Boeing had an advantage was the so-called second mover advantage in business. You see this over and over where one company is sort of the pioneer and they go out into the market and they have a product that is close to being what's right, but the second company that comes along is able to sort of look at what didn't quite work about the first product and improve upon it. Because the Americans were more reluctant to go ahead with a jetliner, Boeing started a couple years later, and the advances that had been made, the technological knowledge at that point, really gave them a leg up. Had the de Havilland Comet not had its problems, though, I think there's a good chance that we would still be thinking of Britain as a world leader in commercial aviation manufacture today.
Among some of the flabbergasting facts that you have in this book is that for all of the advances that have been made in everything over the last half century, there's no more quicker or comfortable way for civilians to fly across continents than the Boeing 707.
It's remarkable. How many technological innovations can you think of where 50 years later we're really not doing things all that differently? We're not flying around any faster or really any more comfortably than were the passengers in the very first Boeing 707 that flew across the Atlantic in 1958. Arguably, we're flying slower because back in those days, you could show up at the airport 15 minutes before flight time, and that was no problem. Continental Airlines actually started selling tickets aloft, and they said that you could now show up at the airport only 10 minutes before flight time as opposed to 20. But also, the Boeing engineers, to their credit, they really got the design right the first time around. It's remarkable how good the 707 was. The jet engines of today are obviously a lot more fuel efficient and quieter and so forth, but the essential process of flying back and forth, you know, from New York to London is really not all that different.
Ever since I finished your book, I've been seeing the world differently.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I look around and notice things that probably wouldn't be there within easy reach from breakfast time on if it weren't for the jetliner. I mean, and include the way that I live, because I fly a lot, and we think nothing of saying, you know, go to Seattle one day and come back the next. That wouldn't be possible without the jetliner.
Yeah, well, I make the point in there that for all of our talk about the miracles of the World Wide Web, and it does do amazing things to bring people together, the Boeing 707 was sort of the original World Wide Web in terms of bringing people together. I guess worldwide wings, you'd call it. But yeah, I feel also that air travel, despite all its hassles and all that, it is still basically a miracle that you can so easily get from one place on the globe to another in a matter of hours. That is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. And we're so blasé about it, but it is really only in the last generation or two that was possible. Think of the choices of the heart that we are able to make, the long-distance relationships we engage in. That was just not feasible before jet travel.
Well, thanks so much.
Oh, this is great.
Sam Howell Verhoevig, his new book is Jet Age, The Comet, the 707, and the Race to Shrink the World. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Travel to Ethiopia, and you might see a heartbreaking sight that's all too common. Children with spines so severely curved, it looks as if they've grown humps on their backs. The condition is the result, in most cases, of untreated tuberculosis, a disease that has largely been eradicated in the modern world, but still rages unchecked in East Africa. But you may also see a heartwarming sight. Children who were once bent over, now standing fully straight, smiling, playing, learning in school. They are some of the patients of Dr. Rick Hodes, an American who's dedicated the last 20 years to practicing medicine in a nation where a doctor can be a rare sight. Some are also his children. Dr. Hodes has adopted or fostered nearly 20 sick and orphaned Ethiopian children. His story was the subject of an HBO documentary, Making the Crooked Straight, and a book, This is a Soul, The Mission of Rick Hodes, by Marilyn Berger. Dr. Hodes has been touring the United States in recent weeks. He joins us from the studios of member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. Doctor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
So what's a nice Jewish doctor from Long Island doing in Ethiopia?
What happened was, back in 1999, I met these two boys with TB of the spine. One of them had a 90-degree angle. One of them had a 120-degree angle. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to help them, and I couldn't get them free surgery, so I ended up adopting them and getting them surgery that way.
As your sons?
As my sons, yes.
Ethiopia has such accomplished people in so many different areas. Why is tuberculosis so rampant?
Well, part of it has to do with the lack of primary medical care and the lack of TB treatment in the countryside. Part of it has to do with a few number of doctors. And part of it just has to do with the nature of TB in Africa, I think, that it's just a very prevalent disease. Now, why does TB go to the spine in Africans? We don't know that. But, for example, here in the United States, you really don't see TB of the spine. In Ethiopia, mm-hmm. I'm following well over 100 of these kids.
Who are some of the people that stay with you the most?
There's a girl named Asmara. Asmara was an abandoned orphan who was living in Gondar Medical College. And I was walking across the grounds of Gondar Medical College one day. One of the docs said, "Hey, Rick, you like these TB cases. Can I show you one?" So I went and I saw her. And she was living in this bed for 3 years because at the age of 9, she had been abandoned there and she had nowhere else to go. She had a 90-degree angle in her back. At this point, she was 12 years old. She hadn't started menstruating yet. She hadn't started her growth spurt. This is the perfect time to intervene because after this, her spine would get a lot worse and she would become paralyzed. So I ended up moving her to Addis Ababa, finishing her TB treatment, and then I sent her off to Ghana. Turns out that one of the best spine surgeons in the world is a guy named Dr. Boachi. And Dr. Boachi operated on Asmara. She now has a pretty straight back, and now she has a future. You know, when I first met her, I said to her, "What do you want to do with your life?" She said, "I want to be a housemaid." Now she wants to be a doctor.
I gather your house has been called the Chabad of Ethiopia, a kind of place of worship on Friday nights.
Well, Jewish people and non-Jewish people converge on my house on Friday nights, and we have big Shabbos dinners, Sabbath dinners. And we stand in a circle and hold hands. We wear funny hats. And we start off by singing, "If I Had a Hammer." And that's sort of, it's not a traditional Jewish song, but I'm sure Pete Seeger would approve. And somehow it sets the tone for the evening.
Dr. Rick Hodes, he's medical director of Ethiopia for the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. And he joined us from member station WXXI in Rochester. Dr. Hodes, good luck to you. So nice talking to you.
Thank you.
There's a different debate going on in the middle of America. It's been raging for generations. You know that state west of Illinois, north of Arkansas, bumped up next to Kansas, below Iowa? What do you call it, exactly? Residents of the 24th state have argued for years over whether to say Missouri or Missouri. It's even gotten a few politicians in trouble. The current governor, Jay Nixon, decided to play it safe. Listen to this.
"I, Jeremiah Wilson Nixon, do solemnly swear to support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Missouri, and to demean myself faithfully in the office of Governor of the State of Missouri.
So help me God.
So help me God."
And help us through this confusion. We're joined now by Calvin Trillin. He's from Kansas City, Missouri, but joins us on the phone from Santa Fe. Is that in New Mexico?
Yes, which is very easy to pronounce.
That's what do you call it, Calvin?
I say Missouri, which is to say I pronounce it correctly.
And you believe this is correct because?
Well, I believe what we would say is that what's what my daddy taught me. He grew up in St. Joe, Missouri, and I think Missouri is particularly prevalent. I've read this. I didn't know this on my own accord. In the northwest part of the state, and the majority in Kansas City, and Missouri, I've always thought of as a St. Louis and therefore Eastern pronunciation.
I am told, because in my ear I can listen to the producer of this segment, and she is from St. Louis.
Yes, I know. We had a little discussion, your producer.
Yes, I understand. And she,
I believe she admitted she was wrong.
but she instructs me that the state is named after an Indian tribe and a river that is pronounced Missouri.
The river is pronounced Missouri if you happen to live in St. Louis. But it's not pronounced Missouri if you happen to live in Kansas City. Although I mentioned this to somebody from St. Louis yesterday, mm-hmm. and she said the reason the people in western Missouri say Missouri is that they can't spell. She was from St. Louis.
Oh, this does get nasty.
I consider that a snotty eastern St. Louis attitude.
Well, Calvin Trillin, the poet and humorist, verse columnist for The Nation, and, of course, a famous native of Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, it's springtime in Missouri, and those blossoms are in the air. That old train goes rolling by a little too fast to care.
This is NPR News.